Today is Wednesday, January 18th. We're going to be working on more chemistry information today. Okay, so last week we talked about two terms relative to atoms. We talked about the term stable and the term neutral. Let's take the term stable first. What does it mean to have a stable atom?
Eight on the outermost.
Eight on the outermost, good. We had a special name for that outermost orbital. We called it a blank shell.
Valence.
Good. Okay, so let's take that word and check each of our atoms. This atom here on the left, we're looking at this outermost orbital or shell, and we're counting to see if there are eight electrons there. So these, of course, represent our electrons. What do you think?
Stable.
Good. So it does meet our octet rule, which means that we have at least eight electrons in the outermost shell. And that means that atom is, you know, kind of in a happy spot. It doesn't necessarily need to trade electrons, share electrons. It's in a good spot. Okay, how about the one on the right? Is it stable?
No.
So what rule does it fail to meet? Does it meet the octet rule? Good. Now, in fact, how many more electrons could it hold?
Four
more. Good. So it's got four electrons. It can hold four more electrons. Good. Okay. So do you feel comfortable with the term stable? Okay. Got any questions on it?
Oh, never mind.
Okay. Let's talk about the term neutral, which is a totally different can of worms. The term neutral has to do with charges. So I need to look at two sets of subatomic particles and compare to see if they're equal. Which two sets? Protons and electrons. Good. So compare the numbers of protons and electrons, see if they're equal. If they're in fact equal, we say we have a neutral atom. So let's first take a look over here on the atom on the left. We have 10 positives. Those are protons. And then how many total electrons does that atom have? Good. So you did the right thing. You did include those innermost orbitals. So there are 1, 2, and then there's your other 8 out here giving us a total of 10. That thing is shaking like crazy. it was doing it last semester, but I thought they had fixed it. It was an HVAC that's making it shake up in the ceiling here. We're all going to have this. Either we're going to have the heebie-jeebies shaking or we're going to have some kind of massive headache from watching that thing vibrate. Okay, so yeah, neutral and stable, they have nothing to do with each other. It just happens to be a coincidence that this atom is both neutral and stable. Take a look at the one on the right there. Is it neutral?
Yeah,
6 and 6. Yep, yeah, so 6 protons and 6 electrons.
It's just not stable.
It's just not stable, right. So it does happen to be neutral, just happens to not be stable, okay? So neutral and stable really don't have anything to do with each other. You know, you can have both, you can have neither, you can have one of each. So it doesn't take one to be the other is what I'm trying to say. Okay, is this something you're more or less comfortable with from last week? Okay, how about questions on this stuff? Something else, let's go back and hit. Can you tell me the atomic number for the atom on the left?
10.
Good, so what did you look at?
The protons.
Protons are 10, good. How many electrons?
10.
Good, so you counted all those orbitals, all those electrons. How many, neutrons do you have?
11.
Good, and your atomic mass?
21.
Good, so what did you add?
10 protons and neutrons.
Good, protons and neutrons, good. On the right, what is your atomic number?
6.
And your mass?
13,
good. How many electrons in your valence shell?
4,
right? How many total electrons?
6.
Good. How many protons?
6.
Okay, and neutrons?
7.
Good, okay. So that's something else we covered in class last period. Any questions on finding atomic numbers, mass, protons, neutrons, or electrons? Feeling good? Okay. Last thing we covered in here last Wednesday was this issue of isotopes. And isotopes are atoms of the same element. They just happen to have differing numbers of neutrons. Good. So let me repeat that. Isotopes are atoms of the same element. They just have differing numbers of neutrons. Okay, and if you need a reference point for that, that was on the top of page 6. Okay, and so iso is a prefix, means same. And so what is similar among isotopes? Their atomic number, good. They're all part of the same element. So how can you confirm that?
Protons,
good. Every one of these atoms has 6 protons. That should ring a bell for us that these are all isotopes of carbon atoms. And so what makes them different from each other?
Neutrons,
good. One has 6, one has 7, one has 8. And just by the nature of varying your neutron number, what also tends to vary?
The mass,
yeah, good. So the numbers of protons and neutrons gives us our mass. And so you're right, the mass tends to vary. Okay, so if you were given a question like this on the test and you were asked if these are isotopes or not, what's the very first thing you should look for?
Protons,
which is your atomic number. Yeah, so look for your protons, that's your atomic number. If they're the same, what does that tell you?
They're
isotopes, good. Just for practice, are these isotopes of each other?
No.
Why not?
Different number of protons.
Good, so they are in fact completely different elements, okay? All right, so I had asked you to take a look at pages 7 and 8 for homework. That practices atomic number, mass, isotopes, all that good stuff. Were there any questions on those pages?
That carbon 14 and oxygen 17, you just had to refer back to the periodic table to make sure that you had your atomic number right before you could do anything else on it.
You could use a periodic table, or you could just take a sneak peek and say, hey, carbon 12 has the same atomic number, and that gives you the information you need. Do y'all have any other questions on page 7 or 8? Are you to the point that you could do atomic number, mass, protons, neutrons, electrons in your sleep? Okay, if you're there and you're like, please just go on with this topic, I'm tired of it, that's where I want you to be, okay? So if you are that comfortable, yay, that's good, okay? If you still need a little practice, there are some practice problems on the bottom of 6. And then page 7 is full of practice problems for protons, neutrons, electrons, atomic number, and mass. So the reason I need you to be comfortable with this is because our next topic is chemical bond formation, which starts on page 9. So let's keep our focus here with chemical bond formation. You'll notice at the very top of your page it says, why do atoms form bonds? And the answer is to gain stability. And so if you've got at least 2 orbitals, a stable orbital has how many electrons?
8, good.
8, or yeah, if you've only got 1 orbital, then 2 is your magic number. Good, so 8 is your magic number. So that's what we're going to be keeping our eye on, is that valence shell and making sure that we have enough electrons in that valence shell for stability. So there's 2 types of chemical bonds. We have ionic bonds and covalent bonds that we're going to talk about first. The difference between them is how they create stability in their valence shells. For starters, the ionic bonds are going to transfer electrons. So let's ignore the after picture here for just a moment. Let's instead focus on the before picture. So we have 2 atoms. Can you confirm that these are reactive and not stable?
Yes.
Okay, so what makes you think they're reactive?
Not enough electrons
in that valence shell. So in fact, 1 electron in that lithium atom on the left, that's only 1 out of 8 that we need. So we need 7 more to create stability. The neighbor sitting over here has 7 electrons. It actually needs 1 more electron to be stable. So you're right, neither one of those orbitals is stable at this moment. Do you see the likely solution to their problem?
Yes.
Just combine. Yeah, just transfer the electron from 1 orbital to the neighbor's orbital, and then you've got 2 atoms that have stable valence shells. So I've colored that particular electron red. Let's follow what happens to it. When you transfer it to the neighboring electron, or the neighboring orbital rather, you've got a valence shell that now has how many electrons?
Eight.
Is that good?
Yes.
What does that mean for us?
Stable.
What rule do we satisfy?
Octet
rule. Good. Okay, so we've transferred that electron. We've now satisfied the octet rule. This atom on the left lost an electron. So we get rid of the orbital. There's no point in having an empty orbital sitting there. And now all we have is an innermost shell that has only two electrons. So there was a rule called the duet rule. What does that rule mean? Yep. If you've got two in that very innermost shell, it tends to be a stable atom. So yeah, this one actually is now a stable atom. It's happy having gotten rid of that one clunker on the outermost orbital. So by transferring that one electron, we've actually made two atoms create a stable setup. So this is a good win-win situation for both of these atoms. Okay, so do you see where the transfer took place? Okay. Now, something I want to appreciate about these is their neutral state. Take a look at the before picture. Is the atom on the left neutral? Neutral means you got equal.
Yeah,
positives and negatives. So, yeah, that one is neutral, right? Three positives, three negatives. Its next door neighbor should also be neutral. Good. Okay, so there's nine positives, nine negatives. So you remember, our general assumption is if you use an atom off the periodic table, it's going to be neutral, meaning equal numbers of protons and electrons. Now, this gets changed when you transfer an electron, so take a look at these two. This particular atom has lost an electron. Do I have a neutral atom?
No.
So I've got three positive protons and only two negative electrons. Okay, so if you need to see how the math works here, we can simply say that I've got three positives and two negatives. That leaves me with an overall positive charge. Okay, so it's no longer a neutral atom. We now call that a what?
Cation.
Cation, yeah. It's called an ion, and to be very specific, it's called a cation. One great way to remember this is that cations have a T in there, and that kind of looks like a plus charge, so that's a really good way to remember this one. So cations do carry a positive charge. That means they have lost an electron. So we don't normally think of things as being positive. If you lose something, we don't normally think of that as a positive thing, right? Hey, losing weight, that would be a positive thing. Okay, so the catch here is that a cation has lost one or more electrons. Okay, and so it's left with an overall positive charge, no longer neutral. Take a look at its next door neighbor. The next door neighbor has nine positive protons. How many total negative electrons?
10
negative electrons. Let's do the math on that also. Okay, that actually leaves me with an overall extra negative charge. Okay, so now I've gained an electron, and I now have an overall negative charge. This particular ion also has a specific name. What do we call it?
Anion.
Good. All right, so sometimes you've seen the prefix A or N used to mean what? Without or negative. Yeah, I know without doesn't make a whole lot of sense here, but actually negative does. So that AN prefix says we now have a negative ion. Another way to think of it is that N there, an anion, is a reminder that it is in fact a negative ion. Okay, so it's gained an electron, at least one.
Has more electrons than protons.
It's got more electrons than protons. That's a good way to put it. So it is this transfer that helps to keep these two atoms kind of nearby. They've experienced a transfer, so they're not going to sit with overlapping orbitals, but they are going to sit close enough because of this charge attraction. You've probably heard that opposites attract, and so the positively charged ion is going to be hanging out close to the negatively charged ion. That's what creates an attraction between these two. So ionic bonds are common in our inorganic compounds. Things like table salt form ionic compounds, and when you put them in water, they tend to break up. Okay, so they weren't a very strong bond if they were able to break up in water. So this is what forms the electrolytes in our bodies. I know that you've heard about, say, being concerned about electrolytes when you're sick with vomiting, flu, diarrhea, that kind of thing. And so what we're concerned about is losing these ions from our bloodstream. These ions, as you find in Bio-211, are really important for maintaining things like blood pressure. Great examples are things like sodium and potassium. We even can include magnesium, chlorine, calcium in this category. So they tend to transfer electrons with another ion, and they're certainly really important for the way our bodies function. It's really important for maintaining blood pressure and hydration. Okay, so what you want to feel comfortable with is being able to spot an ionic bond and then also being able to identify your cation and your anion. Okay, so we'll go through some examples, and I'll let you pick that out in just a moment. All right, so first off, how do you know this is an ionic bond? Transfer of electrons, good. And how can you confirm there was a transfer? Yep, check your valence shells, right? What should you expect to see?
Eight on each,
yeah. And so that tells us they satisfy the
octet
rule. Yeah, so these are two stable atoms. Okay, if you're still not quite convinced that you have an ionic bond, there's something else you can do, and that is to see if they're neutral. Okay, so take a look at the one on the left there. Is it neutral? It's got 11 positive protons and 10 negative electrons. Okay, that's not neutral. The neighbor on the right has 9 protons and 10 electrons. So these being ions is another confirmation that we've had a transfer of electrons. So all you have to do is count your charges to confirm that you've lost an electron from the atom on the left and you've gained an electron on the atom on the right. Okay, now let's take it a step further. Can you tell me which one of these is our anion? The right one. Good. How do you know? Negative charge, an extra negative charge, gained an electron. Okay, so the extra negative charge is going to belong to our anion. The one that lost that extra electron is called a
cation.
Good. Okay, we'll practice that some more as we work through. Let's talk about covalent bond formation. This particular kind of bond formation is a way for us to share electrons. And so sometimes it may not be suitable to just give away your valence electrons. It may leave you shorthanded. So sometimes atoms tend to share those electrons. Take a look at the word. There's a built-in clue. What does the prefix co mean?
Yes.
And valent means valence, right? Yeah, so literally the name tells you what's going to happen here, together or sharing those valence shells. So what we're going to do in this picture is overlap the orbitals and let those electrons orbit each atom's nucleus about 50% of the time. So take a look at the before picture. If we were to simply do a transfer here, you'd have a winner and a loser. One atom would have a stable duet shell, you know, they have two electrons there, and the other would have nothing. So that's not going to work very well. What would work better is to allow the share to take place. These two electrons orbit one atom's nucleus about half the time and the other atom's nucleus about half the time. So it tends to be a good win-win situation when we share those electrons. Because these electrons are being shared equally, should we call it a polar or a nonpolar covalent molecule? Nonpolar, good. So sharing equally means that we have a nonpolar covalent molecule. Yeah, nonpolar means they're sharing equally. I'm going to pass around the attendance roster. If you are new today, just make sure you sign in for me. Anybody here new today? Okay. Kendra. Ah, okay. I've got you marked. Nobody else is new today? Are you Deidre? Okay, y'all just be sure and sign in for me. Okay. All right. So the catch here is that when you need to stabilize valence shells and transferring doesn't do the trick, sometimes atoms will simply share their valence shells and share those electrons. When the sharing is done equally, it's called a nonpolar covalent molecule. Now, let's take a look at one where you've got a polar covalent setup. So first off, can you confirm for me that this is a covalent and not an ionic bond?
Yes.
Okay, so what's the clue?
They're sharing.
Overlapping, good. They're sharing electrons. Okay, so just to confirm, this big atom here in the center is oxygen, and oxygen has 2, 4, 6, 8 electrons in its valence shell. So yeah, it's stable. That's what we're looking for. And the neighbors are hydrogens, and they also have 2 electrons in their valence shells. So the catch is, what we have is a really big oxygen atom in this water molecule. And because it's a big atom, it says, I really want those electrons to orbit me more than they orbit the hydrogens. So that's in fact what those electrons will do. These pairs of electrons will orbit that central nucleus of the oxygen atom and spend less time orbiting the hydrogens. So we have an unequal sharing that's going on here. It's an unfair share that's going on. So I kind of think of it like this. If you've got a really big kid on the playground that wants to play with the toys, that kid gets the toys, right? You're not fighting the big kid on the playground. So the big atom gets its more than its fair share of time with the electrons. Those little hydrogens, what can they do? They don't have the pull to be able to get those electrons to themselves. So this sets up an unequal sharing. We call this a polar situation. And I want you to look for the little symbols because that confirms for us that we have a polar covalent molecule. These squiggles are actually lowercase d's in a Greek language. They're deltas. And so those lowercase deltas indicate to us that there's an unequal share that's going on. Do notice there's a delta positive near each hydrogen atom. There's a delta negative near the oxygen atom. So why a positive and a negative here? We're not doing a transfer.
10 electrons in the oxygen molecule versus more protons in the hydrogen.
Exactly. You've got 10 electrons sitting around that oxygen. That's a lot of negative, right? And there's only 2 electrons down here around those hydrogens. Basically, what you've got are positive protons. So because you've got this big pull toward the orbiting of the electrons around the oxygen, you get a big negative charge up there near that oxygen. So these deltas indicate an unfair share, and it shows you where the electrons are mostly spending their time. So in the case of a water molecule, where do those electrons mostly spend their time?
Oxygen.
Around the big oxygen, yeah. So the delta positives and delta negatives are only going to show up on a polar covalent molecule. Just for comparison, you do not see them here in a nonpolar setup. Okay, so you don't see them in a nonpolar setup. You doing okay so far? Does this make sense?
Yeah.
No. Can I go back to a certain part where have I lost you? Here?
I just lost the nonpolar.
Okay, so you're good with nonpolar?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see where we've got you okay so far. Can you tell me that this is a sharing situation?
Yes.
Okay, and you know this because? Overlapping orbitals, right? They are covalent, they are overlapping orbitals, good. And we share pairs of electrons, so there is in fact a pair being shared and another pair being shared. So we're good so far? Okay. Now, the catch is, we've got a really big atom sharing electrons with really small atoms. Anytime you've got a setup like that, that big atom says, hey, I really want those electrons all to myself, and so it pulls them toward its nucleus. And when it does this, it creates a situation where there's unfair sharing, okay? So these electrons that should be shared equally with oxygen and hydrogen, actually spend more of their time traveling around the oxygen nucleus.
Yes. Okay, so basically, it's because it's the bigger one. So it's whenever it's a bigger atom, that is a polar.
Most likely, yes. Yeah. When you've got this uneven balance of big ones and little ones sharing together, yeah, it's usually the big one that says, hey, I'm greedy, I take. And so that's when you got a polar setup. But you don't have to figure that part out. All you have to look for are the little deltas. And the deltas tell you that there is an unfair share going on. Yeah. So I'm not going to give you something unmarked and then say figure out if it's polar or not. If I give you a polar molecule, it's going to have those delta symbols. Okay. Did we find you?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else got questions? Need me to clear up any part of this? They're supposed to represent where the electrons mostly sit. So you'll notice this delta negative up here is mostly where all of these electrons are sitting, which is closer to that oxygen atom. And so since there's few electrons down here, that delta positive means that there aren't many electrons. So the delta negative is where you have more electrons gathering. So indirectly, yeah, it kind of tells you where the electrons are hanging out. You do not have to determine if it's negative or positive. What I give you would look exactly like this with the delta positives and negatives and the sharing going on. All I'd ask for you to tell me is if it's polar, covalent, non-polar, covalent. Okay.
If there's a delta positive, are the electrons always all shared? Meaning the two hydrogens, all of the electrons on the hydrogen are shared with the oxygen.
Yes. Yeah, and yes, you would only have a delta positive when they're all being shared.
And you have a negative when there's extras up there.
Yes. Yeah. It's basically the greed pull that's got those electrons coming in. Yeah, they're always going to be shared. There's never going to be a transfer situation here. Yeah. So this is a little prettier. You can see the oxygen with the delta negative symbol next to it. And you see the hydrogens down here with the delta positive symbols next to them. Those delta symbols are all you need to know to say, hey, there must be an unequal or unfair share going on. This has got to be a polar covalent molecule. Okay. Hey, since we're talking about covalent bonds, I might as well tell you about singles, doubles, and triples. They're on page 10. Let me emphasize that when covalent bonding takes place, we are sharing a pair of electrons. And to confirm that, we can look at our two previous examples. You'll notice in our hydrogen bond here, we in fact have two electrons or a pair that's being shared. Right? Okay. Take a look at our water molecule. There's a pair being shared. There's a pair being shared. If the pair terms kind of throws your mind off, just think about shoes. You know, you don't ever go into a store and say, I just like the right shoe, that's all I want to wear. You know, you buy them in pairs. Electrons are shared in pairs, only in pairs. Okay? And so if you're talking about a single covalent bond, you're talking about a pair of electrons being shared. If you're talking about a double covalent bond, you're talking about two pairs of electrons being shared. So it's like walking in the shoe store saying, give me two pairs of shoes. And if you get a triple covalent bond, how many pairs are you sharing?
Three
pairs. Okay, so we have to think here in terms of pairs that are being shared. Now, there's a shorthand to this, which makes our lives a whole lot easier. This is kind of shortcut to organic chemistry. Every time we want to talk about carbons and hydrogens sharing electrons, it gets old trying to draw this stuff out. So what we can do is use a chemical shorthand that uses lines to represent the chemical bonds. So you'll notice, here's a carbon, there's a pair of electrons shared with the hydrogen, and all they've done is represent it with a single line. What does that single line represent?
One pair,
yeah. So what kind of covalent bond is it?
Single.
It's a single bond. Hey, there are no deltas on this picture at all. No deltas. Nonpolar, yeah. So you can confirm there's no deltas. That means it's nonpolar. So is this sharing done fairly, or is it being pulled in one direction? It's fair square, yeah. So we've got an even amount of sharing that's going on here. All right, so next picture shows that we've got two oxygen atoms. Take a look, there are four electrons being shared among the valence shells. Got to think in terms of pairs here. So this is what type of covalent bond?
Double,
good. Now, this time we can use what looks like an equal sign. In fact, it's just two lines, and that represents the double bond. So oxygen is this atom. The double bond is that double pair share right there. And the other oxygen atom is this one. So that's a whole lot easier than having to draw out two oxygen atoms sharing electrons with a whole thing going on in between. So this is chemical shorthand. Boy, when you start sharing three pairs of electrons, it gets really crowded. So these are the three pairs of electrons being shared. And this time, we represent those three pairs with three lines. Is this a single, double, or triple covalent bond?
Triple,
good. Is it polar or nonpolar?
Nonpolar,
good. How do you know?
No deltas,
yes. So even, equal sharing.
Okay. No deltas.
No deltas is nonpolar, yeah. So now that we've kind of been through all this stuff, let me emphasize, when you see something where there's single, double, or triple lines, the emphasis is, hey, these are covalent bonds. That means that we are sharing electrons. We do not use these lines when we're talking about ionic bonds. Okay, so this indicates a single bond, double bond, or triple bond. Let's take this bond here between the two carbons. Okay, what kind of bond is that?
Double.
Okay, and there's three lines here that represent?
Triple.
Good, okay. All right, well, completely switching gears. Down at the bottom of your page, you've got hydrogen bonds. Okay. So first of all, there's a lot going on in this picture, and I want to start with what you recognize. Do you recognize any kind of covalent bonds? Okay. So they are shared, right? Okay. In fact, these are water molecules. There's your oxygen, your hydrogens, and you should recognize the delta symbols there. That indicates what?
Polar.
Good. So we've got a delta negative and a delta positive, so a lot of good information comes just by examining these water molecules. Well, sitting over here is another water molecule. You've got another oxygen, hydrogen, and of course those delta symbols are something to look for. And then you see something strange. You see a dotted line connecting one water molecule to the neighboring water molecule. That is what we call a hydrogen bond, and it's a very weak attraction between neighboring molecules. Look closely. What is that attraction between?
Hydrogen
and an oxygen. Good. What delta symbol sits next to your hydrogen?
Oxygen.
Yeah, and the delta negative sits on the neighboring oxygen. What do you know about opposites? There you go, right? Okay, so there is a slight attraction between the delta positive and the delta negatives on those neighboring molecules. So this hydrogen bond is a weak bond?
Yes, because of the dotted line or because of the positive and negative?
It's because of the positive and the negative, and it's not a true, there's no transfer here, and there's only just the weak attract, the charge attraction that holds the molecules together. That makes sense? Okay, there's no transfer here. There's no sharing here. It's just a weak attraction among opposite charges. That's all it is.
How does it become an attraction?
How does it become an attraction? Okay. How it becomes an attraction is all due to oxygen being greedy. And when oxygen is greedy, it pulls the electrons away from the hydrogens. And that leaves the hydrogens all lonely with just that one positive proton. That gives us a slightly positive charge. And so it says, oh, that slightly negative charge sitting on a neighboring oxygen on another water molecule is somewhat attractive. So it kind of creates a little bit of a bond between those two. You've got to have polar molecules to do this. Okay, you will not have this kind of hydrogen bonding setup between nonpolar covalent molecules.
So basically it's weak because it's really not attached to that one, but it's kind of trying to cheat with itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And on the test, if you were to show that, it would have the dotted line and we would recognize it.
Yes. Yeah. Always look for the dotted line. I believe in pretty much any situation, they'll give you a dotted line. Yeah. So even though this seems like it's kind of a silly little attraction, it's actually really important because this is what makes up over 70% of your body's mass. You know, as a baby, we're about 80% water. By the time we're in our 80s, we're about 50% water. So, you know, this is certainly a very important attraction for the water molecules in our bodies. Even DNA is held together with these hydrogen bonds, these very weak attractions. So, to kind of put this in perspective, if you go to a kitchen store, sometimes they will sell these kitchen cutting mats that say that they're self-healing. You ever seen those in the grocery store or perhaps in a kitchen store? No? Okay. So you have an assignment now. Got to go shopping. Okay. So if you go into a kitchen store, a lot of times they do sell these self-healing mats. And you think, well, you know, how does it actually heal if you cut the mat? If you don't cut too severely into the mat, they've got them set up so they'll reform hydrogen bonds across the surface. So that kind of is an interesting concept that they can use hydrogen bonding even beyond what the human body uses it for.
Yeah. So a hydrogen bond would never be polar or nonpolar. The delta are just there to show us the opposite attraction.
That's right. That's right. And it's not a share, not a transfer. It's not polar, it's nonpolar. But you make an important point. It always is going to occur between polar molecules. Yeah, it's not going to occur between nonpolars.
Tell about the weak bond.
The weak bond, yeah, that attraction right there.
It's the same thing with a shooting target or a bow target, how they pull the round out of the arrow out and it seals back.
Okay, so hydrogen bonds there. Yeah, interesting stuff.
You said it was 70%, makes up 70%.
In a newborn, it's about 80. By the time you're to late teenage, early 20s, you're looking at 70. By the time you're in your 80s, you're looking at 50% water. And I've actually got that in there. We'll come to that probably today or maybe Monday. Okay, so now you've covered three chemical bonds. Let's go through a slideshow and see if we can figure them out. All right, so what kind here? You got it, good. That positive up there means cation, that negative means anion, and that means what has happened between those two?
Transfer.
Good. So who gave away the electron?
Cation.
Good. And of course the anion picked up that electron. So what's a really good clue that says there was a transfer here?
When the proton and electrons don't equal the electron.
Good. Protons and electrons don't equal each other. And there's no overlap here either, so that should also say, there's probably not a share going on here, okay? So if you were given these two on a test and you were asked which one is the cation, would you feel comfortable picking sodium?
Yes.
Okay, so what clue did you use?
That positive charge.
That positive charge. Good. It had to have given away an electron, okay? And if you were asked to identify the anion, chloride has a negative charge. Good. So that negative charge says it gained one or more electrons. Okay. So ionic, covalent, hydrogen.
Covalent,
good. Polar or non-polar?
Non-polar.
How do you know?
No delta symbols.
Good. Why is this not a hydrogen bond? Good. Yeah, non-polar. Yeah, you're right. No dotted line means that there are no hydrogen bonds here. I'm just checking because these are hydrogen atoms, right? But you would have to have a dotted line going to a neighboring molecule. Good. So you picked up on the right clue there. So if we wanted to write this one in shorthand, I didn't want to draw out all those atoms, I could simply put a carbon in the middle, my four hydrogens around. And how many lines between each carbon and hydrogen?
One.
Just one. All right. So that single line is called what type of covalent bond?
Single.
Single bond. Good. All right. So what do we have here? Ionic or covalent? Covalent. Good. What type of bond exists between each carbon and hydrogen?
Single.
Good. That means how many pairs of electrons are being shared?
One.
Just one pair. Okay. And in reality, how many is in a pair?
Two.
Two. Okay.
What was the first question?
That's what I asked.
Okay. So, ionic covalent, what you got?
Covalent.
Good. And then between each hydrogen and carbon, we have a
single.
Good. So the reason this is not ionic is there's not been a transfer, and we don't use these lines to represent transfers. We use those lines to represent share. Okay, so anytime you see those lines, we're indicating some type of covalent bond. Would you say this one is polar or non-polar?
No
deltas, this is non-polar. Okay. So far, so good.
So if you were answering this question, it would be as a single covalent bond? That would be the answer for that?
That would be the answer, yeah.
But if you were to ask what was the relation between oxygen and carbon, it would have been a double.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Those two lines just threw me out of the way.
Oh, yeah, those two, they're kind of long and weird, yeah.
Well, I guess it was because it was double. I wanted to say double the whole time.
Yeah, that would be double, but you're right. The rest of these are singles.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have to read the question.
That always
helps,
right?
I was just saying that.
We're all guilty of that. Sure. If that O was a hydrogen, I'd have to circle it and ask you what kind of bond that was there. Because otherwise it would be kind of confusing since some are singles and that one would be a double. Yeah. All right, let's see. Covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
Good. How do you know?
Sharing.
Good. And there's orbitals overlap. And in fact, there are how many pairs of electrons being shared?
Two.
Single because it's pairs. I don't know.
It's
two pairs.
It's double.
Okay.
Yeah,
there's a lot of tubulite there in there, but then once it stops, you got to catch the shaking and then it's always done.
Yeah, the shaking's like making my eyes go, you know. But yeah, those two are on the innermost orbitals. Yeah, so there's a pair and there's a pair. I'm hoping they'll stop the shaking by next Monday.
Mm-hmm.
All right, polar or non-polar?
Non-polar.
Because there are no deltas. Good. All right. Ionic or covalent? Good. Polar or non-polar?
Non-polar.
There are no deltas. Good. Now, between every carbon fluorine attraction, there's a pair of electrons being shared. And is that a single or a double or a triple share?
Single.
Right. So don't fall into the trap of saying there's two electrons, that must be double. A pair, of course, is a single bond. Okay?
So it's not two from that
the outside atom. It's actually just two period that are shared.
Two period that are shared, yeah. Those two right there.
Gotcha.
I have a question.
Sure.
Are all these like review questions, they're all detailed?
Yeah, this is my basic chemistry PowerPoint and lecture PowerPoint set up.
Question. We didn't get
the attendance roster back here.
I don't know
where. Ah, okay. Thanks for letting me know.
Yeah.
Did the whole middle not get it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Thanks for letting me know.
Can you draw a triple
covalent bond? Yeah. Let's see. It would have six electrons between the two atoms. Nitrogen is a good example of that. So it's tight in there, but that's six being shared, yeah.
Okay, that's
fine. Is there going to be more than a triple?
That's it.
Okay.
That's it, yeah. Hydrogen, and the big clue?
Weak.
Dotted line, it is a weak attraction. And the rule for hydrogens is you've got to have one polar molecule sit next to another polar molecule. And how do you know these are both polar?
Delta signs.
Delta signs, good. So look for those polar molecules to have hydrogen bonds, dotted lines representing those hydrogen bonds. Okay. So these are weak attractions between hydrogen, which has a delta positive, and something else that has a delta negative. It may be an oxygen on a neighboring molecule. It could also be nitrogen or fluorine, but as long as it fits the rule of having a slight negative charge, that's what the hydrogen is attracted to. What type of bond here between the two carbons?
Double bond.
How many total electrons in a double bond?
Four.
Good, okay. And our last one here, what kind of bond took place between lithium and fluoride?
Ionic.
Good. How do you know?
It's transfer.
And the orbitals do not overlap. Okay? And there's another great clue. There's a positive on the lithium and a negative on the fluorine. That indicates what?
Cation
and anion. Good. So they're no longer neutral. Okay? That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you more or less comfortable where we've been so far?
Yeah, I mean,
it's a lot.
Go ahead.
Right before you got the next slide, it says something about how many electrons.
Yeah, if you've got a double bond here, how many total electrons are shared? Yeah, two pairs of shoes. I got to think about shoes that way. Just a little more chemical shorthand, and then we're going to move into inorganic bonds. Let's see, some chemical shorthand is on page 11. If we simply mean to indicate one hydrogen atom, or one atom of oxygen, or one atom of anything, all we need to do is use the symbol for that element. It is not necessary for us to use a coefficient, which would be a number in front of the symbol, nor is it required for us to use a 1 as a subscript. So let me tell you about subscripts and coefficients for just a moment. It is unnecessary for us to use ones as coefficients in front of the symbol, and we don't need to use a subscript behind the symbol either. It's kind of repetitive or redundant to put ones there. So when we're talking about a single hydrogen atom like you see here, we just simply use an H to represent that atom. That's all that's necessary, okay? Easy enough, that's a pretty easy one to start with. If we simply have two hydrogen atoms and they're not chemically bonded in any way, now we're going to use the coefficient. That's the big number in the front. And so we should say for this example, 2H. Good. Now here's where your skills come into play. Are these two atoms bonded to each other? They're not overlapping. Have they transferred electrons?
No.
They haven't transferred electrons. There's no delta positives, no delta negatives for any kind of polar covalent molecule. So after you go through the list of things, you really find that there's no bond here at all. So since they're not bonded to each other in any way, then we say that we've got 2H, two hydrogen atoms. You with me so far? We still have two hydrogen atoms this time, but are they bonded?
Yes.
How do you know?
They're sharing.
They're sharing. Good. They're overlapping orbitals. Is this a single bond, double, or triple?
Single.
How do you know?
Two electrons.
Good. Two electrons being shared means there's a single bond taking place. Hey, polar, nonpolar?
Nonpolar.
No deltas. Okay. So this time we want to indicate to somebody that we have two hydrogens that are chemically bonded together. It wouldn't necessarily give the right idea if we said 2H, because we use that for two hydrogens that were not bonded together, right? Okay, so how should we relay this information to somebody using chemical shorthand? Subscript, good. Now we're gonna use a subscript. What number should we use for our subscript? Use a 2. Good. So this particular picture should be represented by H2 since we've got two hydrogens bonded together. You so far so good? Okay. Now see the difference. These are not bonded, so we use the coefficient. That's the number in front. This is 2H. When they are bonded, ditch the coefficient and this time use the subscript. This is H2. All right, a little more complicated here. This time we've got four hydrogens. Let me give you some options to think about. Is 4H the way to go?
No.
What does that tell somebody? There's four separate atoms, you're right, they're not bonded. That's not what we have. Would H4 be the way to go? All four connected. Yeah, so we don't have all four connected. We've got a pair connected here and a pair connected there. So what we should do is this. We should use a coefficient of 2. That's the big number in front. And that tells me we have two molecules. Molecules are bonded atoms. And so the 2 as a subscript tells me how many atoms are bonded together. Now you can multiply the 2 coefficient times the 2 subscript, and that gives you 4, right? And that tells me in total, I'm looking at 4 atoms in this picture. Okay? But the way you write it, it's going to indicate to someone exactly how the relationship between those atoms are set up.
So it's 2H2.
It's 2H2, yeah. So take a look at this one we just did a few minutes ago on the board. Two nitrogens bonded by a triple covalent bond. How should we write that one?
2, 3.
How many nitrogen atoms are there?
2.
Okay, should I put it as a coefficient or as a subscript? If I put it as a coefficient, it means that those nitrogens have no relationship. Put it as a subscript because they do have a bond taking place between the two of them. So another way to write that is simply N2. Okay, if you said N3 with the subscript N3, That tells me how many atoms are in the bond?
Three.
Three, yeah, and there's in fact only two nitrogens in that bond, right? Okay, you wanna do a few more?
Sure.
Yes.
Let's see. This probably will help us out. This review page here, number 5, how many potassium atoms are in that compound? K2PO4.
One.
Because it doesn't have one.
So what's the symbol for potassium?
K.
And K has a
two.
Yeah. P is phosphorus, right? Okay. So K2, yeah, that's our number. That's our subscript. That tells me that there's two potassiums bonded together. Okay. Here's another one that kind of takes us back a little bit. How many electrons are in the valence shell of nitrogen if it has, say, an atomic number of 7?
7.
It's only two valence shells. Or one outer, but one inner.
Yeah, there's two in the innermost orbital, and that leaves you 5 to put in the next orbital, the valence shell. You see how that works? Okay. So if you're placing electrons, 2 fit in the innermost only. And if I have an atomic number of 7, that means I also have 7 electrons to distribute. The remaining 5 go on the next orbital. Okay. Let's see, the mass number of sodium, what do you think there?
11.
Add 12 neutrons, 11 protons, 23 is correct. Here's one to really look at, number 8. This time we have oxygen double bonded to oxygen double bonded to oxygen. So how many oxygen atoms are there?
Three.
Okay, so I've gotten a couple of options. Because they're bonded, I have to pick, do I use the coefficient, which indicates no bonding, or do I use the subscript, which does indicate bonding?
Subscript.
So I should write O3. Does that make sense? Okay. Why would O2 for this one be incorrect?
Three total atoms,
right? It doesn't really matter what kind of bond. All that matters is that there is some bond holding those together. Okay. And then our last one there, how do isotopes vary? They have the same number of protons. Neutrons, good. Neutrons vary. Okay.
Mass
number varies too. Good.
Same number of protons, different number of electrons.
Same number of protons, different number of neutrons. And then the mass number varies. I left some practice problems at the very bottom of that page for you guys. There are answers down there too. We've got about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to flip on over, do a little bit of inorganic. That's going to start you off on page 14. So today and Monday, we're going to talk about compounds, which indicate there's been some kind of bond formation to take place. We've got two categories. We have inorganic compounds and organic compounds. Inorganic compounds are ones that typically are ionically bonded. They lack lots of carbons and hydrogens. We do see carbons and hydrogens in organic molecules. And inorganic doesn't necessarily mean that it's not made by a living organism. It may, in fact, may have been made by a living organism. So the inorganic prefix there, that IN, doesn't necessarily indicate what it's made by. Okay, so when we're looking at lots of carbons, this is what we mean. Notice all the carbons and hydrogens in this particular molecule. That's a great example of an organic molecule. On the left, though, we see an inorganic molecule. Notice the lack of numerous carbons and hydrogens. So that's the difference between those two. That's what we're looking for. Let's talk about water. That is our most important inorganic molecule or compound in our bodies. It makes up around, say, 70 or 80% of a newborn's body, and we become drier the older we get. You know, the joke is that we prune up and become little raisins as we age. It is no joke. By the time you're in your 80s, you may only have 50% of your body made from water. So our body spaces become replaced by tissue spaces, and we tend to hold less water the older we get. So this whole issue of water is important because it helps us to stay hydrated. You know, babies and older people oftentimes have trouble staying properly hydrated, and that's because of body size as a baby or the lack of water making up those spaces as an older person. So what do you know about the water molecule?
Polar.
It's polar, good. It's covalent, good. What do those deltas tell you?
Polar.
Okay, so we're looking at which atom being the greedy one?
Oxygen.
Oxygen, right. It pulls those electrons toward it, and it spends more of its time, spend more of their time orbiting oxygen, less of their time orbiting the hydrogens. So the term polarity indicates that we have an unequal or unfair share that's going on here, with oxygen being the greedy atom. And this whole concept of polarity is the reason that oil and water don't mix. And, you know, your plasma membranes are made up largely of nonpolar lipids. So you think, good gosh, how do our bodies even hold together if you're, say, 70 to 80% water? And your plasma membranes are made up of fats. So there has to be some way for all of this stuff to be held together. That's kind of where we're headed with all of it. Let's see, the term cohesion means that water molecules tend to stick together. What is the name of the type of bond that is a weak attraction between polar covalent molecules?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, good. Now, if you were to see these on a test, you should look for a
dotted line,
good. And these hydrogen bonds always occur between polar covalent molecules. Confirm that by looking for your deltas, right? Okay, so there's some nice hydrogen bonds. That's what makes water molecules tend to stick. And so our blood, for instance, is largely water, and so the water molecules in there stick thanks to these hydrogen bonds. Another issue with hydrogen bonding is the high heat capacity or the high heat of vaporization. What is normal body temperature on the Fahrenheit scale?
98.6.
Good, 98.6. Go outside on a 110 degree day, and you could stay out there for quite a long time and not become a steam cloud, right? You can also go outside on a 0 degree day for quite a long time and not turn into an ice block. All of this temperature resistance is due to hydrogen bonding, thanks to the polarity between those oxygen and hydrogens and water molecules. So what high heat capacity means is we have a great ability to resist temperature change because we're largely water. So our bodies resist heating up, our bodies resist cooling down. In fact, you have a lot of watery compartments around your brain, your eye, you have them around your organs, you have them, you know, around a baby, for instance. So this water is all there to help resist temperature change, known as the high heat capacity. Let's see, water is also a good chemical reactant. It is a solvent used in many reactions. In terms of cushioning, it's found in many important locations in your body. The number one location is where?
Cells.
In your cells, yes. So you may want to highlight that is often a test question. The number one storage location for water is inside cells. That's down near the bottom, intracellular fluid. Is the most common place for water to be stored. You'll notice it's like 2/3 of your bodily fluids. Intracellular, yeah.
Is it number one storage for water?
Number one storage place for water, yeah.
It's just in our cells.
In your cells.
Or the intracellular compartment, I guess you could say either one.
You could say either one. You guys have heard of cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is largely composed of intracellular fluid. And you can call it ICF for short. Extracellular fluid is the fluid outside of our cells. It only accounts for around 1/3 of your bodily fluids, and blood is a part of that extracellular fluid. Interstitial fluid is also considered extracellular, and it's situated between your cells and tissues. If you've ever had a water blister pop up on your skin, that's full of extracellular fluid in the interstitial space. Literally, it's between the cells and the tissues. So that's just kind of a general rule of thumb, is that the majority of our fluids are stored inside cells. We call that ICF, or intracellular fluid. Okay? How about questions on that page?
All right, you said the extracellular fluid is found outside the cells, but the interstitial fluid surrounds the cell. What's the
Extracellular is any fluid outside of the cell anywhere, so it could be like the humors of your eye, but interstitial specifically refers to the tissue fluids, the ones that are between cells and tissues. Like amniotic fluid is extracellular, but it's not technically interstitial. Let's see, why don't we start with page 15 on Monday. We'll pick up with electrolytes, and then our job will be to work through some of those organic compounds on Monday as well. If you guys have any questions on chemistry that we've covered so far, let me know Monday. Okay.